On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In the news this week, the State of the Union and the Bush presidency.
Yet we can go forward with confidence because the state of our union is strong. Our cause in the world is right. And tonight, that cause goes on. God bless.
Why are you elected? If you wanted a safe job, go sell shoes.
I'm in to win, and that's what I intend to do. Thank you all very much.
I've concluded this isn't the time for me to mount a presidential campaign.
You don't read Runway.
No.
And before today, you had never heard of me.
No.
You have no style or sense of fashion.
President Bush stands and delivers, but can he find support from the American people or Congress? Republican pushback Senator Chuck Hagel says the administration is playing ping pong with American lives and lays down the gauntlet to fellow lawmakers. Bombings and bloodshed rage on in the streets of Baghdad. Hillary Clinton joins the pack of presidential hopefuls. John Kerry decides to sit this one out. And Meryl Streep gets a nomination for Best Actress. Does the devil wear Oscar? This hour, On Point, our news roundtable goes deep inside the headlines. We have a top-flight panel with us this week. In Washington, Linda Robinson, senior writer for U.S. News & World Report, covering national security and military affairs. She's been embedded with U.S. troops in Iraq and is author of Masters of Chaos, The Secret History of the Special Forces. Linda, nice to speak with you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also in Washington, Susan Milligan. She's national political correspondent for the Boston Globe. Susan, hello to you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, as always, nice to have you.
Hello, Jane, Linda, and Susan.
A lot to get to. Let's start with President Bush's State of the Union. Linda Robinson, your impressions of his speech.
Well, on Iraq, which I think is still topic number one in the national conversation, he didn't really offer anything new to gain support for this surge policy of sending 21,500 soldiers over. He basically asked, let's give it a chance to work, and he told people, you did not vote for failure, speaking to the Congress. But in terms of concrete efforts to answer the questions that are out there, such as what kind of benchmarks are you going to hold the Iraqi government to deliver on their end of it, he didn't supply anything. And as we will discuss later, there are a raft of resolutions coming up in Congress that are going to try to put some more pressure on him.
Before we get to all of that, let's listen to President Bush's words. Some of them calling for more troops and what he called victory.
This is not the fight we entered in Iraq, but it is the fight we are in. Every one of us wishes this war were over and won. Yet it would not be like us to leave our promises unkept, our friends abandoned, and our own security at risk. Ladies and gentlemen, on this day, at this hour, it is still within our power to shape the outcome of this battle. Let us find our resolve and turn events toward victory.
Find our resolve, shape the outcome of this battle, turn events toward history. Susan Milligan, what, if anything, in this speech led you to believe that's possible?
Well, I don't know whether it's possible or not, but the one thing that really struck me about the president's speech was how subdued he was. You know, in previous speeches, he's been, you know, sort of swaggering a little bit and kind of saying what he wanted as opposed to asking for what he wanted. And he wasn't even completely asking in this speech, but he was certainly showing a little bit more deference to the Congress, obviously cognizant of the fact that he no longer has a Republican majority that's going to do largely what he wants. But, you know, there was no smirk and there was no language like axis of evil. He was definitely more subdued than he'd been in previous State of the Union speeches.
And many say Virginia Democrat Senator Jim Webb, who delivered the Democratic response, was not at all subdued. Let's listen to part of his speech.
The president took us into this war recklessly. He disregarded warnings from the National Security Advisor during the first Gulf War, the Chief of Staff of the Army, two former commanding generals of Central Command, whose jurisdiction includes Iraq, the Director of Operations on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and many, many others with great integrity and long experience in national security affairs. We are now, as a nation, held hostage to the predictable and predicted disarray that has followed.
Linda Robinson, your response?
Well, it's very interesting. Of course, there's been a three-month debate over the way ahead in Iraq, and now you do have people like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Peter Pace, lining up behind this surge policy after a lot of reported opposition from the Joint Staff. But I think what's going to happen now is all the attention's really going to start focusing on General David Petraeus, who had his confirmation hearings this week, who will be replacing George Casey as the top general in Iraq. So I think and his hearings were quite candid, and we can talk about them as we go forward here. But basically, he was saying, I think it's doable. It's going to be tough. You know, you could say he's being the good soldier about it. He did acknowledge there's some question about whether he's being given sufficient numbers of troops. But he said it's going to be tough, and it's going to be late summer before there's any real indication of whether this is going to work or not.
Let's listen to Lieutenant General John Petraeus, who appeared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, as you mentioned, in this exchange with Senator Edward Kennedy. General Petraeus says there is no timetable yet for when U.S. forces would come home.
I don't know what the time limitation is at this point.
At this point, therefore, we should assume that they'll remain over there until we hear further from you.
As they're needed for that particular mission, yes, sir.
And there was this exchange with Senator John McCain about the need for more troops.
Suppose we send you over to your new job, General, only we tell you that you can't have any additional troops. Can you get your job done?
No, sir.
General Petraeus also told the Senate Armed Services Committee this week that the situation in Iraq is dire. So with that as a backdrop, what are the benchmarks now for progress in Iraq? Linda Robinson?
Well, the very first benchmark, and the only one that's really been clearly defined is, publicly at least, is that the Iraqis are supposed to supply their three brigades worth of Iraqi soldiers to help in this new effort to secure Baghdad. And they're supposed to flow in here over the next couple of months. Some of them have arrived. I think 2 to 3 battalions are there. But if they do not pony up their contingent of Iraqi soldiers, we're going to know it. And that's going to cause, I think, a lot of people to say, wait, hold on a minute. And even people like Senator John Warner, and this is actually part of the substance of his resolution, is saying, let's wait and see if the Iraqis do their bit before we commit all of our forces.
Jack Beatty, please go.
Yeah, and I think we got a preview of what's to come earlier this week in a battle on Haifa Street. There was a fight going on between Shia and Sunni militias, and our troops came in at 4 o'clock in the morning. They were supposed to meet with Iraqi troops. They were going to together move against these groups. The Iraqis didn't show for some hours. When they did show, they were locking around, fooling around. And when they started to search the buildings where snipers were, and a sniper killed an American soldier, the Iraqis wouldn't go into every room. They were careless about it. And at one point, when the bullets were flying down at the soldiers, a sergeant yelled out, "Who's shooting at us? Who's shooting at us? Was it Shiites? Was it Sunnis? Was it the Iraqi army?" That, I think, is a paradigm of the kind of chaos that we're headed for, and also of the Iraqi army basically saying, you guys do it to our forces.
Well, let's listen to the vice president talk about some of this, the more troops going to Iraq, and his insistence that this plan will work. Here he is with CNN's Wolf Blitzer, Vice President Dick Cheney, saying the administration is committed to moving ahead with this plan.
Fact is, we can complete the task in Iraq. We're going to do it. We've got General Petraeus taking over. It is a good strategy. It will work, but we have to have the stomach to finish the task.
What if the Senate passes a resolution saying this is not a good idea? Will that stop you?
It won't stop us.
Susan Milligan, president sounded more conciliatory this week than Dick Cheney did.
Well, except that the president has sounded more conciliatory, but he actually hasn't been more conciliatory. I mean, he's made it pretty clear that he's not going to let Congress tell him that he can't send an additional surge of troops over. It doesn't look good for the president, and clearly some of the Republicans on Capitol Hill are trying to either stop that resolution or pass a weaker resolution. But the point is, if he does this, well, he is doing it. He's going to be doing it alone.
This is Linda. I just want to jump in here because I think there are just some very fundamental questions about this new approach that haven't been answered. And one of the primary ones is, are there enough numbers? I mean, if you're going to search, have you even got enough? And by a formula that's often used, you need 20 troops per 1,000 population. And you're still about 30,000 short in Baghdad to meet that formula. As Petraeus emphasized in the hearings, though, he said it's how you use them that is important, and they're going to try to emphasize population security, more the local beat cop than open combat. But the big problem there is you have got to bring the Iraqi factions together somehow. And this is why people like Senator Carl Levin, who's now the chair of the Armed Services Committee in the Senate, says how you've got to have a political solution. You, in effect, need like a peace process there. You can't just wait for the Iraqi government to do it, because it is very unclear that the Iraqi government has the capability on its own to resolve the fundamental core issues of this conflict.
Let's turn to presidential politics now. John Kerry's out. Hillary Clinton is in. And she said this week she's in to win the Democratic presidential nomination. She doesn't seem to be worried about the very crowded field either.
I decided that I would contest for the primary, and I'm looking forward to it. It'll be a great contest with a lot of talented people, and I am very confident.
Senator Joe Biden of Delaware said it's too soon, much too soon, to crown Hillary the nominee.
Hillary Clinton is going to have to make her best case, and there's a lot of us out there that are known, but in a sense not known, and we're going to make our best case. And I don't think Hillary's best case versus mine or Barack's or anybody else's necessarily trumps us.
Susan Milligan, your initial assessment of Hillary Clinton's announcement?
Well, I think she's certainly a formidable candidate, and nationally she appears to be the front runner, if you can even call someone a front runner, you know, nearly 2 years before the election. But her problem is that everybody in this country has made up their minds about her already. So she's beyond the point of introducing herself to people. She has to erase some people's impressions of her and then you know, reestablish it. There's a poll out by the Marist Institute for Public Opinion in Poughkeepsie, New York. It showed that 47% of voters said they would never vote for her. And, she doesn't have a lot of room to play with there. And she's a great fundraiser. Her husband's a great fundraiser. She's got a good network of support going back to, you know, the 92 campaign. But I definitely don't think that she's the presumed nominee. I think a lot could happen between even just now and December, never mind when we get into the primary season.
Linda Robinson? Yeah, Jack Beatty, please.
I was just going to say, and her candidacy is already, I think, threatening one of the basic props of political reform in the United States, and that is publicly funded money for the campaign. She is going to be the first candidate who will say, I don't need the public money either in the primaries or in the general election. And that's heading toward, that'll be her half in what could well be a $1 billion campaign overall.
And what does that mean for the other candidates, Jack?
Well, it means that, you know, it's going to be a money primary, and the moving up of the big state primaries. Illinois is talking about it, New Jersey, California. That again will simply put more and more emphasis on money, and Hillary has the money. But she's done a severe damage here to that principle of public funding, which helped to deal with the corruption of the Nixon years. Mm. But you know, her responsibility is great, but not as much as the taxpayers. You know, everybody gets a chance to click off check that box on the income tax returns that says $3 contribution. In the 80s, as much as 35% of Americans were doing that. Now it's down to less than 10%. And that is why there's so little money left in that kitty to provide funding adequate to run a modern campaign. And that's on the citizens. That's on us for failing to understand that we can take presidential politics off the auction block.
Linda Robinson, what about her position on the war, her initial support of the war? Is that a problem in the Democratic primaries?
Well, probably in the primary. I want to just quickly thank Jack for making that point, because, wow, this is going to be a money campaign. And I think you'll see it quickly coming down to Hillary and Obama, or whoever the big money people are who can pull in the money. But I think on the war, you know, Hillary has positioned herself, I think, already in a way for the general election, not to be a target of cutting off funding to the troops and that kind of thing that would be very tough for her in a general election. But I think now she's trying to say, all right, let's talk about a cap, or let's talk about some measures that will increase accountability on President Bush for the next couple of years in Iraq. But none of these candidates want to inherit Iraq as their problem.
And this is Susan Milligan speaking. I think that Clinton's position on the war is going to give her a lot of problems in the primary, because the Democrats feel as though this has been the big debacle of the Republican administration. Mm. And she's just never renounced her vote, not like even John Kerry has or John Edwards has. And I think she runs the risk of running into something like John Kerry did in 2004, was saying he voted for it before he voted against it. I think she's going to have to come out a lot more strongly against the war and renouncing her own vote for it.
This is Linda. I just want to come back and say, I think that that's an interesting test to see whether the primary politics will push her to that. She recently said something like, I have the responsibility gene. You know, she's looking at Iraq, and she, as many of those senators up on the Hill, Capitol Hill, know, you can't just walk away from Iraq or you will buy yourself a boatload of problems in the whole region. So I think what's needed is a responsible alternative policy that someone lays out in great detail that answers all of the unanswered questions. So if she comes up with that, I think she can dodge that bullet of having to just, for pure politics, renounce the whole vote to go to war.
Let's talk a little bit about the senators who have been discussing Iraq on the Hill this week. No less than 12 hours after the president's speech, the senators got to work on a non-binding resolution. And I want to go to hear Senator Chuck Hagel, who said the administration has no Iraq policy. And he told fellow members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that it's time to stand up and do the right thing.
There are real lives. And we better be damn sure we know what we're doing, all of us, before we put 22,000 more Americans into that grinder. And I want every one of you, every one of us, 100 senators, to look in that camera and you tell your people back home what you think. Don't hide anymore. None of us.
Chuck Beatty, it's not the Democrats that are the problem for the president now. It's the Republicans.
It is, and it hasn't gotten the attention it deserves, but Senator Warner, former chairman of the Armed Services Committee, he's circulating a resolution that will disapprove of the president's escalation, and it is going to get a good deal more support than the Hagel-Biden resolution. And that is going to be, I think, quite telling for Republicans. You know, there's some people now fearful that, on the Republican side, that the point of view outlined by Jim Webb in his first paragraph in his speech, which was, we are the party that wants to take the troops out of Iraq, the Democrats, and they are the party that wants to send more troops to Iraq. The fear among Republicans is that's the message the public will get. And they want to quickly show, wait a minute, we're not all for that, especially the senators who are up for re-election in 2008. So they don't want to be saddled with this escalation.
Mm. Susan Milligan, can you explain for us exactly what this non-binding resolution means? What will it do exactly?
It won't do anything from a practical perspective. I mean, certainly the president's made it clear that it's a non-binding resolution, and the president's made it clear that it's not going to influence his opinion. But it does put everybody on record, and it really puts the Republicans on the spot, because they're in a position of either having to go against their own president or go on record in favor of an expansion of a very unpopular war. It's possible they could move beyond this and try to limit funds for the war. No one is going to cut off funds for the war as a whole. That's not going to happen. They don't want to be perceived as not supporting the troops who are already on the ground. But they may take some action, as was done, you know, during the wind down in Vietnam, and, you know, as they've done in Colombia and so forth, to limit the actual number of troops or to even limit funds for an expansion of troops. That may happen, but that'll be a much harder thing to get past.
So, Susan Milligan, Boston Globe, regarding this plan to send more troops to Iraq, the president essentially pleaded with Democrats, and, of course, many Republicans, for that matter, to quote, give it a chance. Mm-hmm. What are the chances of that?
I don't think the chances are very good, especially as you have the presidential campaign approaching. This is just not a popular war. So going out and telling your constituents, we're going to send more troops over there, when there isn't a lot of evidence that the modest number of troops that they're sending would actually be the magic bullet, if you will, to stabilize things over there. I mean, it's a huge gamble.
What is
Jane?
Yes, please.
If I could jump in, it's Linda. I want to go back to my original point. I think the State of the Union address was a huge missed opportunity for the administration to reach out not only to Democrats, but to people like Senator Warner and say, I'm going to address some of these concerns. You know, he did offer this bipartisan working group, but that's just a forum. He gave no indication that he was actually ready to try to address some of the concerns. And it's not, Jack did mention correctly, there has been some progress on a few of the issues, but there's a whole basket of issues that have to do with bringing the Sunni minority in Iraq into the fold and let them believe that they are part of the new Iraq. And that also includes reining in these Shiite militias. And we are far from having a clear indication that that is going to happen. So anyway, those are the issues that I think that if the president wants to really make people believe he's listening, he's got to give some substantive revision to what he's put on the table.
Let me turn for a moment to another important moment in the president's State of the Union address. It was the first time the president delivered his speech with a Democrat staring down his back and a woman at that. President Bush began his address by acknowledging Nancy Pelosi as the first female Speaker of the House.
Thank you very much. And tonight I have the high privilege and distinct honor of my own as the first president to begin the State of the Union message with these words, Madam Speaker.
Linda Robinson, an historic moment. Is Nancy Pelosi measuring up in this new position?
Oh, I think it's early really to do a serious evaluation, but I think that was a great moment. I mean, you know, for every woman in America, certainly, and I hope the men too. It's really quite a historic watershed that the president graciously recognized. You know, that was the kind of tone, in a way, you would want to have seen even more generous, you know, outreach and a real sense of let's bring this country together. He did. We haven't talked a lot about the other proposals he made, but there's a kind of a sense that they were modest and not sweeping initiatives, though he may get some progress, for example, with Democrats on immigration. But I think the gesture to Pelosi was quite welcome.
Let's talk about some of these other issues that you bring up. The president discussed several things, the first of which being the need to cut the federal deficit.
We set a goal of cutting the deficit in half by 2009 and met that goal 3 years ahead of schedule. Now let us take the next step. In the coming weeks, I will submit a budget that eliminates the federal deficit within the next 5 years. I ask you to make the same commitment. Together, we can restrain the spending appetite of the federal government, and we can balance the federal budget.
President Bush also talked about reducing dependence on foreign oil.
Tonight, I ask Congress to join me in pursuing a great goal. Let us build on the work we've done and reduce gasoline usage in the United States by 20% in the next 10 years. When we do that, we will have cut our total imports by the equivalent of 3/4 of all the oil we now import from the Middle East.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Susan Milligan, do you think we'll really see something done regarding renewable energy?
Well, yeah, I think that they will do some things on renewable energy, although certainly a lot of Democrats and environmentalists felt that the president could have gone a great deal further in his comments on energy and on global warming, although he didn't actually call it global warming. He called it global climate change. Mm-hmm. And that they think that what he's doing is that it's much like the surge in Iraq. It you know, if he'd done it in 2001 and it had been bolder, that it might have done something. But what he's calling for, a 20% reduction in gasoline use to be accomplished through an increased use of ethanol and a gasoline additive, as well as the possibility of creating more fuel-efficient cars. But he's been against a mandatory, mandatory standards for that. So I'm sure he'll get something passed on Capitol Hill, but it's not nearly as dramatic as I think the new Democratic majority wants to do.
Well, Linda Robinson, what about that? Healthcare reform, immigration, education, some of these other things we've been talking about. Any real hope of getting anything done domestically, given the situation that's going on in Iraq?
Well, there is Iraq, of course, and of course we're in now entering the high political season. But I think, as Susan said, you know, there's a chance, I think, for some modest gains on energy policy. I also think, as I said, the immigration bill stands a chance because Democrats have been more in favor of that, frankly, than Republicans. So with the Democrats taking over both houses of Congress, you may get some form of a temporary worker program, which is really the centerpiece of what President Bush has been pushing really from the beginning. I mean, I remember he first went down to Mexico and his friend Vicente Fox, who was then president of Mexico, early in his first term, promising to do something about this. So that might be possible. I'm no expert on the health care issue, believe me, but I think there are some problems that people have already raised about that. But again, you may get some help to states for their Medicaid emergency room, dealing with the poor, the hospital bills for the poor.
Yeah, Jack Beatty, weigh in on this, would you? What is your...
On the health care, he really wants to give a tax deduction to poor people so they can buy insurance, and he wants to pay for that by taxing, in many cases, middle-class people who have very good plans already. So that is going nowhere. But the classic comment on that was delivered by Stephen Colbert on this tax deduction for low-income people. He said, it's so simple. Most people who couldn't afford health insurance also are too poor to owe taxes. But if you give them a deduction from the taxes that they don't owe, they can use the money they are not getting back from what they haven't given to buy the health care they can't afford. That's about the status, the logical status of this Bush health care proposal, it seems to me.
Linda, is that you? You want to jump in?
Well, I just wanted to say quickly, as I think the most optimistic estimate is it only takes 5 million under this plan, if it works, only 5 million of the 47 million Americans who do not have any health insurance will get covered under this new scheme. So, again, it's not a bold overture to solve what people recognize as one of the critical problems of this country.
And this is Susan. I think that Jack had it right that it really isn't going to help a poor person buy health insurance, because if you don't pay taxes, a tax deduction isn't going to help you. A tax credit would, or a refundable tax credit might. But the other thing about this plan, which we should say for our listeners, would provide a $7,500 standard deduction for single people and $15,000 for families to buy health insurance, is that it takes the employers out of the equation. And a lot of people think that it would then discourage employers from providing health care because they'd say, well, just, you know, buy it on your own. Use your tax deduction to do it.
I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're making sense of a week in the news. Susan Milligan, Linda Robinson, and Jack Beatty are with us. Talk more about presidential politics. Hillary Clinton wasn't the only Democrat to throw her hat in the ring this week. New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson says count him in, too. He's not deterred by his underdog status.
I know I'm an underdog in this race, and I won't have the kind of money that others have in this campaign. However, I believe this is a grassroots campaign, and I will outwork everyone to get my message to the voters.
We have a caller from Beverly, Massachusetts, who would like to talk about this particular piece of the race, Governor Bill Richardson. Adam is calling. Adam, you're on the line.
Hi, this is actually Ed. Thanks for taking my call. But, I'm an independent voter who leans slightly Democratic in presidential elections. And I'm looking at 2008 and concerned about the fact that the Democrats might be a little too seduced with the rock star status of a Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, neither of whom I think would be that electable in a general election against some of the Republican potentials. And you know, what bothers me is that we're always looking at the resumes and kind of, you know, the qualifications of presidential nominees. And in my mind, Bill Richardson is eminently qualified, not only from, you know, the chief executive of a state in the governor of New Mexico, but also, you know, as a former ambassador to the UN, he's got the foreign policy experience that we often look for.
Well, thank you, Ed, for your call. Linda Robinson, what about that? Ed mentioned the rock star status of some of these other candidates. Would an underdog be credible?
Well, I think that the caller makes an excellent point, and I guess traditionally it's considered that governors have a better chance than senators at the top job of president of the United States. But, you know, you just have also this money factor that we mentioned before, and I think money gets you attention, gets you television, it gets, you know, you front runner status, gets you the media attention, then things sort of become a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I think it's also quite interesting, this question of who's electable? What's the general election forecasting going to be? But it's early, you know, it's early. And Obama, of course, has to overcome the issue that he's really a freshman. You know, he's quite young and unproven. But I think a lot of people are looking to him to be a uniting figure or more of a centrist, which again points to who's electable in a general election.
Ed, thanks for your call. John is calling from Amherst, New York. John, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Jane. Hi, guests. You know, I think the world has kind of gone topsy-turvy. You know, we discuss everything as far as what's going on in the Senate, and we have a non-binding resolution. I'm serious. Where, folks, is the guts? We have people, and I'm going to say public radio is a tad on the left, and I really don't care. It doesn't even matter to me. But but the thing is, what we have is a situation where Chuck Hagel has trotted out, and he's no conservative. I really don't care what you folks have said. I am a conservative. I don't like the definitions being defined for me. And as far as like your guest talking right now, your one guest referred to the healthcare thing as a scheme. The other one said it would hit middle class. Hey, whoever said that about middle class, you do realize that there's a $15,000 threshold as far as premiums paid. I have a very good plan, and mine don't even come close to $15,000 paid. So it's not like a middle class raid on their money. But folks, George Bush is the only one who has shown any kind of guts whatsoever in this whole thing. He's not doing this for politics, but everyone who has voted, including the Chuck Hagels and all the Democrats, have done it strictly for political purposes.
Jack Beatty, your response to that? John, thank you for your call.
Well, on the tax on the health care issue on the deductions, I mean, unions are protesting precisely because, in fact, in some very good union plans, the United Auto Workers and so on, they have what Bush called gold-plated plans, dental, psychiatric, you name it, they've got it. And that they don't want that to be taxed. And, you know, I don't think the problem in America is that people have too much health care. This idea of, you know, taxing gold-plated plans to take care of people who don't have insurance, this has been kicking around in the conservative, and this is used as a exact term, conservative, you know, think tanks for years. And the basic premise of it, that we have too much health care, just seems to me to be really off in a nation when we have 47 million without insurance and where, you know, people have all kinds of medical problems.
Let's turn from health care to another new piece of news this week, the Scooter Libby trial. Mark is calling from Boxborough, Massachusetts to talk about that. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Fine. Thank you.
It seems that the Iraq war didn't just come in through the front door in the State of the Union. It came in through the back door in this Scooter Libby trial. And a lot of people thought it was going to be a very limited trial, limited to whether Scooter Libby lied or told the truth. But in the first few days of testimony, what it showed is that this trial is really going to pull the curtain back and has started to pull the curtain back on what was going on behind the scenes. And in particular, the obsession of the vice president, in particular, to the leak by Joe Wilson and his efforts to control it. And it's fascinating to read the testimony of people like Cheney's communications director, Kathy Martin. And she testified today, or yesterday, I guess it was, about the way that they tried to control it, and even to the extent of pulling CIA people, third-ranking CIA officers, out of meetings in order to try to put a damper on this, and then drafting. She participated with Steve Hadley and Scooter Libby in drafting George Tenet's mea culpa, where he took the blame for the 16 words. So I think what you're going to see is that this story is going to just continue to grow, because we're going to see the extent to which the vice president and his office were involved in trying to silence this story and manipulate the media to do so.
Mark, thanks for your call. Linda Robinson from U.S. News and World Report. Is this bad news for the vice president?
I think the caller's made some excellent points, and I would say in general it's true. I think some people maybe had expected this to be kind of an inside Washington story, but because of the number of people being brought up and the fact that it really does, I think, show the also a split within the administration. You have kind of the neoconservatives versus the moderates, and I think the vice president is very much front and center on this. And there have been some rumors around Washington of a possible, for health reasons, resignation of the vice president, you know, this scenario that would have Secretary Rice coming over and taking his place and then John Negroponte moving up at state. So I think actually this could become a big story nationally.
And this is Susan, and I think that it will be amplified by the release that, you know, we expect may come pretty soon of the second part of the Iraq intelligence investigation on the Hill, where the first part had to do with whether the intelligence was flawed. And the second part, which we'd not gotten an answer on before the election, was whether the information was, you know, either ignored or even deliberately manipulated. So these two things happening at once could give the administration some problems.
Got a call coming in from Providence, Rhode Island. Valerie, hello.
Hi, Susan. How are you?
Good. What's your call?
I thought I saw a totally different speech from the president. I thought the president's speech was incredible, his State of the Union. I think he hit on almost every issue, energy deficit, war in Iraq, health care. I thought it was incredible, and I think that that he has an incredible moral compass, and I appreciate that. I voted for him, and I would vote for him again. I think the Democrats have become very, very divisive. Maybe it's because of the election, maybe because so many people are running. I think the Democrats are fantastic at dismissing the new ideas that he's come up with, but I don't think they have ideas of their own.
Jack Beatty, do you want to respond?
Well, the public agrees with Valerie, at least in one respect. Asked last week in a CBS poll, do the Democrats have a plan for Iraq? Only 16% said they do. So there's a feel, and of course the Democrats would come back, wait a minute, we've had all kinds of plans, redeploy out of Iraq, the Biden plan, the partition Iraq, we have plans. But they don't have a party plan, and Bush does. Now, of course, the argument is that it's the wrong plan. In a dialogue earlier this week, or maybe it was last week, with Nancy Pelosi, she asked him, why did he think that this was going to work, this escalation would work, when the others haven't? As recently as last year. And he said, because I have told the generals it has to. And she said, well, why didn't you tell the generals it has to on the other escalation?
Mm. This is
Susan.
Linda. Linda.
Uh-huh.
If you don't mind, just like to jump in with a quick comment, because I don't want to leave the impression that I think it was necessarily a bad speech. You know, I think it was kind of a measured, I would say modest speech, not sweeping, not eloquent. But I think if you just look at the substance, there wasn't a new addition to what he's announced on Iraq. So there was no further effort to try to pull people in. And I think he desperately needs more political support to go forward in Iraq. And I think more broadly to turn around a presidency and start working for what his legacy is going to be. Similarly, on the domestic front, I think while he did make concrete proposals on key issues, they were not sweeping proposals, and he did leave, I think, questions about whether he's going to try to take on the entitlements issue. So that's just where I would sum up the speech.
Well, beyond that, Linda, I know you thought one of the great moments of the address was when the president recognized the, quote, real Americans in the chambers, correct?
Oh, yes. I thought, you know, that can be kind of hackneyed at times. It's become a standard feature now of the State of the Union. But I think especially Wesley Autry, I mean,
yes,
they were all good. But this, you know, humble man who rescued the kid and from the train tracks. And, you know, he just stood up and he took his moment in the limelight. And I think, I don't know, many people's eyes might have teared up. Mine certainly did.
Let's take another call from Nashville, Tennessee. This one, Jim, you're on the air, Jim.
Hello. Two quick comments. One, on health insurance, it's not just a matter of affordability, but availability is even more critical. Insurance companies are allowed to cherry pick, and if you've got health problems, you can't get health insurance privately at any cost. Only universal health care is an answer to that problem. The other comment I have is on alternative plans for Iraq. The second ostensible reason for the invasion was to free the the Iraqi people. We've done that. It's now their choice as to what to do. We don't need to stay and try to manipulate that with any force level. We need to get out. They decide what they want to do. They're a sovereign country. It's their decision, not ours. We don't need to sacrifice our people to manipulate internal politics.
Jim, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. You mentioned Iraq. I'd like to listen now for a moment to John Kerry, who announced on Wednesday that he will not make another run for the White House. Instead, he will focus on efforts to end the war in Iraq.
And as someone who made the mistake of voting for the resolution that gave the president the authority to go to war, I feel the weight of a personal responsibility to act, to devote time and energy to the national dialogue and an effort to limit this war and bring our participation to a conclusion.
Susan Milligan from the Boston Globe, an emotional speech for John Kerry. 08 was really his last chance.
Well, probably. And it was very emotional. And I was very struck by how the senator, who's a very private person and doesn't show a lot of emotion, how his voice was cracking and he was almost breaking down in tears as he announced this. And we forget sometimes, I think, just what an intensely personal and emotional decision this is. But I think it could be very liberating for Senator Kerry, and Iraq could be this sort of bookend issue for him in his career, where at the beginning of his career, he volunteered for Vietnam and then, you know, became one of its most vocal critics. And that defined a lot of the early part of his public life. And now he voted to authorize the use of force in Iraq. And now he's become a great critic of it. And now that everything he does isn't going to be seen through the prism of, you know, presidential politics, I think actually he can sort of settle in and just really focus on the Senate and really focus on Iraq. I think it could be kind of a growth period for the senator.
Jack Beatty?
Yeah, and he went on to say that he wants to end this war and prevent another one with Iran. Mm-hmm. He gave a strong warning about that. And today's Washington Post reports that the president has ordered the forces to kill or capture Iranians they apprehend, not just simply to arrest them and let them go. Now, that's a very serious business if we start shooting at Iranian agents in Iraq. And that's what Kerry warned about in his speech. And, you know, his last line from his famous Vietnam testimony of 35 years ago, how do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake? That should hang over the whole debate here. How do we ask these soldiers who've done so much, and as our caller Jim points out, they've done everything that's been asked of them, how do we ask the last man to be the one to die for this mistake?
In our last 2 minutes here, I want to turn our attention briefly to Ford Motor Company. Lost $5.8 billion in the fourth quarter of this last year for a deficit of $12.7 billion, the largest in its 100-year history. Ford is banking on restructuring. Linda Robinson, is it enough?
Well, I have to say I'm not a business reporter, but when I heard that they're not planning to return to profitability for 2 years, I thought, whoa, this is a long, tough slog for what used to be one of America's great companies. Mm. So it's I think, quite an interesting pass.
Sad period, Susan Milligan, for indeed a great American company.
Yes.
Yeah, and a point where the government can really make a difference. What is it? Is it $1,500 to $2,000 the cost of a car is for the health insurance for the employees? Under national health insurance, that cost would be off them, and they could compete with the Japanese, who in fact have national health insurance plans.
So we'll turn to a much lighter note to end our hour here. Oscar picks. Best picture pick for any of you? Jack Beatty, start with you.
Oh, gosh. My favorite picture of the year has been The History Boys, which isn't nominated. So I'd say Babel would be my Babel, however they're saying it. I thought that was a really, really strong picture.
Linda Robinson, Susan Milligan, have you seen any movies lately?
This is Susan. I was a big fan of Little Miss Sunshine, although I'd be surprised if they picked it for Best Picture with some of the very, very serious contenders there. But it was a brilliant independent film. I like a movie that isn't built around some movie star, and this was just brilliantly acted and written.
Linda Robinson, you get the last word.
Well, I have to say I'm in the same boat as Jack, but I think Babel's supposed to be a very good film, and I think Clint Eastwood's done some great war movie making.
My pick, Letters from Iwo Jima. I'm with you on that. Susan Milligan, Linda Robinson, and Jack Beatty, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate you being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.